So, I think we should speak a little bit about what we have already spoken of, just for the benefit of everyone and the benefit of those who haven't heard. The topic of this course is the relationship between the Siksha, Diksha, and gurus and Prabhupada. And we titled it Siksha, Diksha, and Founder Acharya. Who is more important? And then we began tracing out the history since Prabhupada left, but right before Prabhupada left and after he left, and things we misunderstood and things we learned. And we haven't come to the present, almost to the present. And when we come to the present, we're also going to look towards the future. See what we still haven't understood. But as we looked at the past, the first misunderstanding we had was that we placed primary importance, not primary importance, we placed predominantly all importance on the Diksha Guru. Then Prabhupada's position, it seemed to become, it was almost becoming historical, like, he was dominant when he was here. Then, after he left, there were 11 gurus, and now they were the dominant ones. So everything tended to focus on them and away from Prabhupada. And then you saw things like, well, because it was kind of natural, because gradually, different parts of the world, most of the devotees now in the movement in that part of the world were disciples of this guru. Was it used to all be just disciples of Prabhupada? So, just from that angle of vision, the focus shifted. And as that was shifting, many of the Prabhupada disciples became alienated, and so they were moving outside the movement. So, as they would move outside, that means you had more of the new disciples and less of the Prabhupada disciples. And so, each zone had a predominance of disciples of one guru. So, it naturally tended to create focus on that one guru. Now, in many ways, it created extreme unity within that zone. But what happened was it created disunity internationally, because the zones tended to be very competitive, or ISKCONs within themselves, in a sense. Not that we weren't unified entirely, but they were definitely movements within themselves, at least compared to when it was with Prabhupada and compared to today. So, during that time, not only did the position of Prabhupada get relegated, what we would say, out of the center, because then there's always talk, put Prabhupada in the center or bring him in the center. So that meant they felt that he was got pushed out of the center. And it was, in some ways, it was conscious, in some ways, it was not conscious. It was just logistically, now you have all these disciples. So now you have, in a temple, big temples or big zones, thousands of disciples of this guru and 12 disciples of Prabhupada. So you just understand what would happen. And things like Vyasa Pujas for the current gurus were huge. And then Prabhupada's Vyasa Pujas were not so huge, because the impetus to do those were the Prabhupada disciples. There were less of them. And now the new disciples were more focused on their guru, because they thought that he was almost on the level of Prabhupada, or in some way on that level. So it was almost like Prabhupada's their guru. But I have nothing to do. But he's everything for me, and Prabhupada's his guru and the guru of his godbrothers. But the reality is, this is my guru, and that's all I know. And it also was like, you as Prabhupada disciples, you worshipped your guru on a very high level, so we want to worship our guru in the same way. So don't deprive us. We want to have the big Vyasasanas. We want to drive him in a limousine. We want to have the beautiful rooms, the Rolex watches, all these things we did for Prabhupada. Don't deprive us of our devotion. But inadvertently, what was happening is it was segregating the movement, and it was the focus on Prabhupada as a founder acharya was being lost because the focus was on these other people. Now, I would say that maybe a minority of those gurus even wanted to be in that position. Some of them, maybe due to subtle material ambition, or didn't really see the problem, but most of them did see the problem. And most of them didn't really want to be in that position, and they did it because they thought that's what was they were supposed to do. It's not that I want, you have to worship me this way. If they ever thought that way, it was because they thought that was right, not because I want it. Of course, you know, we all want to be worshipped and so on, but I would say predominantly it was that they thought this was the right thing to do. And because they thought it was the right thing to do, if they didn't get it, they would make sure they would get it, because they thought it was bad for their disciples, because the guru was being minimized. So then, even the idea of bringing Prabhupada more in the center, in the minds of disciples, it looked as a minimization of their guru. That was the problem. And I particularly remember times maybe it was Prabhupada's, I don't even know if it was his appearance or disappearance day, but I would, probably his disappearance day. And I would focus on the need for us to unite around Prabhupada and please him, which, you know, if you said that today, you would just think, yeah, I've heard that. That's obvious. But in those days, it would be taken as you're pushing my guru out and making him, but you're neglecting him. And I take that as an offense. You're offending my guru. That's how they would take it, believe it or not. Though you might think, well, that's crazy. I'm just trying to see if they can hear me. One devotee had a bad connection in Mexico.
Yeah. Cool.
Prem Kishore. So. So during that time, we saw, one of the things we saw happen was gradually programs that were succeeding during Prabhupada's times were gradually diminishing. So you saw, after Prabhupada left, you saw a rise in book distribution for 2 or 3 years, and then it started declining. So there was a there was like a connection between Prabhupada's position being relegated to lesser importance and the movement starting to decline. So after Prabhupada left, there was momentum. The same momentum. It actually got, the movement actually increased for about 3 years because of the momentum. So it was going very strong, but it started declining. And then year after year, it was, for a period, it was actually getting worse. And there was an alienation on the part of many devotees, particularly disciples of Prabhupada, who could see that this was wrong. Even the ones who thought it was right in the beginning could see now it was wrong, and it's having adverse effects. And many Prabhupada disciples are leaving. Not all of them left Krishna consciousness. Some of them just left for other movements, Gaudiya movements, took shelter of other gurus, or started their own movements. Because one of the problems that organizations have, at least our movement has, and I don't know if you've experienced this, and I think it's human nature, and you actually have to consciously work against it. If there's problems, there's generally not systems for ordinary devotees to deal with them. It's like you see a problem, what do? Unless you're friends with the temple president, or you're in management, the average devotee generally, they don't have facility, especially in an issue like this, which is so sensitive. How do you tell somebody that you shouldn't be worshipped this way when you have 500 disciples who are ready to hit you in the head for saying that? And if you're just an average devotee in the temple and you're not in management, or you don't have a very close relationship with the leadership, there's no real program for discussing. It's not, okay, we have Istagosi, let's discuss the guru issue. So that's been true in most temples I've been in. I mean, smaller temples, it's not such a problem because you're always talking, but bigger temples. And so many devotees just, they couldn't do anything. So they were just sidelined. And some of them just stopped being involved in the temples, some left the temples. So at that point, there was a decline. And then, as we were saying the last few classes, devotees were leaving, which gave more power to the guru because there were less, in a sense, he didn't mind because there were less people objecting to what he's doing. It was more autocratic. He had more power, you know, because the godbrothers are, you know, going to say, no, you shouldn't do this. So that just becomes a botheration. So it creates disunity. So with less of them around and only the ones that would support him, it was more unified. So then along the way, the impossible started becoming possible. The unthinkable started happening. And that was the gurus who we thought were divinely empowered by Prabhupada, who we felt were some of the most advanced devotees, who then became divinely empowered, believing that Prabhupada chose these people as the most special and then endowed them with Shakti, and we would call them pure devotees. There were 11 pure devotees in ISKCON. You know, previously, when Prabhupada was asked how many pure devotees are there on the planet, he said, how many devotees are in ISKCON? And they said 1,000. He said, then there's 1,000 pure devotees. And then, but this time now, in 1970, after November of 77, now there are only 11 pure devotees. I mean, that's kind of how it came out. Although those 11 wouldn't really say that, but it was kind of an unstated truth. He's a pure devotee. Prabhupada chose him. He's a pure devotee. And publicly, you would never talk about anyone else as a pure devotee, generally. Maybe one or two rare people, or maybe after they died, or something. So you had 11 pure devotees empowered by Prabhupada and elevated, apparently, to a very, very high level where they could be qualified to be guru. Because our understanding is, how could you be guru unless you're super, super above everybody else? Or there's some empowerment. So, okay, you're the best devotees, and now you've been empowered, so you know you're doubly special, and we're just ordinary devotees. So then it created this whole problem about succession of gurus. Okay, if these are like special, 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 then how many other special people are there in the whole movement? There can't be that many. And so the GBC very reluctantly were allowing other people to initiate. I think subsequently in the next 3 years, only two or three people were taken on board to initiate, or 5 or 10 at the most. I don't even think that many. I only remember a few, maybe 2, 3 years later. So there was a reluctance, you know. It's kind of like it was looked at now as a club. And how do you get in the club? How are you going to get in there? And you want to initiate, you're inspired, how do you get in there? You know, well, we have to look at you and see, are you... Because once you get in that club, you're a rare breed in ISKCON, and you have extreme amounts of power, right? Because wherever you're preaching, everyone's going to become your disciple. So you can have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of disciples very quickly within a few years. So you're going to be very prominent, and you have a lot of control. So they saw it that way. And I don't know what was going on in the GBC, but obviously at some point they had to start discussing the relative difference between GBC power and guru power. But it only came up as a paper a few years ago because it was a problem. Because another thing I didn't talk about is during that time, the gurus had ultimate control over everything. So let's say you're my disciple and you're preaching in this temple and I say, I need you to come with me. And you're like the Sankirtan leader and I just say, come with me. They just lost their Sankirtan leader. I don't say that every guru did it that way, but they had the power to do that, and often they did it. I mean, many gurus worked well within the zones and cooperated, but, you know, you have special talents that I need, so I just tell you, I need you to come with me and do this, and you tell your president I'm doing that. And they say, you're Grihastha, what can he do? Even Brahmacharya, you might just do it anyway. So while that was going on, so there was this conflict between management, because gurus could undermine, and the disciples always saw the gurus above management. He's my guru, I have to do what he says. No, but I need you to do this. Nobody, my guru is above you. So the seeds of those problems existed. We saw them all along, but we didn't know how to deal with them because, you know, the guru, we also gave deference to the guru. Okay, you know, I may be the temple president, but you're the guru, they're your disciples. So many temple presidents just said, okay. And many temple presidents were frustrated with it, but what could they do? And usually the guru was their GBC anyway, so. So I don't know how pervasive that problem was. In some places it wasn't such a problem, because the guru was more sensitive. In some places it was, especially where the guru wasn't the GBC, right? Because then he didn't know what was going on, and he wasn't working with the temple president. So the gurus had extreme amounts of power, and they were being, as we said, they were being worshipped every day with guru puja. And then generally, they had such prominence that in their zones, they gave class every day. So even you'd have so many qualified godbrothers, they were the only ones that gave class because, well, I'm the guru and my disciples are here. They don't want to hear you, they want to hear me. That was the kind of the idea, right? So we're like this during Prabhupada's time, or maybe the sannyasis are here, everybody's here, right? And then Prabhupada left, and you could even say this went down, this not only went up, this went down a little bit. So then it's like this. So therefore, they're giving class every day. So that naturally, in the minds of everyone in the temple, where does that put the godbrothers and where does that put him? That he's obviously above everybody. So because of that, there was no soil for the concept of Siksha Guru to manifest, because it's like this. So even if the relationship of Siksha Guru was there, you wouldn't notice it because you'd only think he's the only one because it's like this. And no one even, aside from that, no one talked about Siksha Guru. I don't think anybody really understood it. We understood there was Diksha Guru, and Diksha Guru was everything. So both the six, so Prabhupada went down and the Siksha Guru was already down. He never came up. It never became a reality. And then the unthinkable started happening, where some of these leaders started to have difficulty, and that popped a bubble in the whole pure devotee. And because the idea of pure devotee is also you're infallible. Guru never falls down. You go to the Shastra, Guru is perfect, Guru is this, Guru is that. Then the bubble got popped. Okay, you could say, if it happened once, you could say, okay, just an odd, unfortunate situation. It didn't happen once. It happened 8 times. And every time it happened, faith decreased. Not in just those disciples. Everybody. You started losing faith in your guru because 4 or 5 of these amazing gurus, pure devotees, worship the Guru Puja every day, ran off with some woman. Unthinkable, right? So now, you have all these godbrothers who are saying, I told you so, I told you so. They're not pure devotees any more than anyone else is a pure devotee. And so that created massive chaos. More people exited ISKCON. And I wanted to talk today a little bit about people leaving ISKCON, because when we say Siksha Diksha, founder Acharya, particularly in this time, because everybody was initiated, there was the realization of Siksha, of who a Siksha Guru is, but it was all outside of ISKCON. It wasn't realized inside ISKCON. We first realized what a Siksha Guru is by devotees going outside of ISKCON. That's how we understood it. So now, as I was saying, God brothers, God sisters would see the seeds of these problems, but you couldn't talk about it because if you talk about it, you're offending the pure devotee and you're envious and we don't want you here. And so often, even some devotees were asked to leave zones because they were thought to be envious because they were making these points. Don't sit on the big seat. Don't put yourself above your God brothers. You have to open up initiation to other people.
Don't give class every day. We shouldn't say that you're perfect. When you preach Shastra, you're perfect, but you may make other mistakes, and we have to adjust. There's all things we never had to deal with. Prabhupada make a mistake. You never had to think like that. Every set is perfect. Krishna's speaking to him. Now, you know, you ask your guru, should I marry this person? And he said, yeah, but it turns out to be a horrible match. You realize that he didn't know anything about marriage. That's not his field. You know, ask him about book distribution. He can tell you about that, or deity worship. So it was a growing, you know, realizing, okay, we thought they're up here, so whatever they say must be perfect in every level. And then, so then there's discussions. No, it may not be perfect. And then that's creating problems. But what do you mean? That's the way we grew up. It's what the Shastra says. He's perfect, don't doubt. So there are these growing pains. But all along, or gradually, both, all along for some or gradually for others, the God brothers were understanding these things, but there was no way to bring it to the forefront. And during those times, the God brothers and God sisters, they came to the conclusion that we can't do anything, only Krishna can do it. And then the guru started falling. And that's how everything changed. That was the only way it could change. Because then it's like, okay, that pure devotee up here, it's not. We're all here. This is your service. It's just a service. You're not up here. And so many devotees can do this service. It's the service of instructing and guiding and taking care of devotees, which so many of your godbrothers are doing anyway, and they're connected with your disciples, the six-year group. So then when they came down, then the concept of six-year group could now have soil to grow in. Before that, you know, even if you had it, you didn't know it was a six-year relationship. That was a huge problem, because I saw that. That was driving me crazy. I saw that a lot of the relationships between the guru and disciples were not real. It was just, they never had any connection. They had connection with this person on the ground. And the reason they took from that guru, the scene was like this. I'm preaching to you, you're coming to the temple for 6 months, this and that, you become a devotee. So then I'm the bhakti leader, I train you, or I'm the temple president, I train you. You know, you've been there for so many years. And then it's time to get initiated. So you get initiated from the local guru. So you don't even think that I could be your guru. You don't even think that there's any other guru. You probably haven't seen that many. Or when you see them, you don't think that's a possibility. It's just so it's a conveyor belt. So without any real deep connection or anything, it's just, yeah, it's like, okay, this is like, you know, you join the bhakti program, and then you go in Sankirtan, and then this, and then you get initiated. It's just like, it wasn't really that such a deep thing. So I look at that and I think, this is so artificial. This person has a connection with this devotee. He doesn't have a connection with the Diksha Guru, and now he's getting initiated from the Diksha Guru. And at a certain point, when God brothers and Diksha Gurus didn't see eye to eye, then the God brothers would think, I'm making the devotees and I'm turning them over to him. And once I turn them over to him, I kind of lose. Not only did we not see Diksha connections, the whole relationship changed. It was like, now I'm a different person once you're initiated, because all your focus was on your guru. And he's your guide. I don't have a lot of influence on you anymore. So the God brothers are starting to think, do I want to make devotees to turn them over to this person who I don't even agree with what he's doing? I don't always agree with everything he says. So it created conflict, because these other people should have been gurus also, and they should have had many gurus in a temple. So the solution to the whole problem actually was that the gurus fell down. That was the way it was solved. Because as long as they were there and holding on to their positions, this chaos would continue. Now, one thing happened. You know, the gurus were like holding on to their seats, most of them. You know, they were holding, because they thought this was the way to do it. This is the way Prabhupada did it. And so there was discussion by some gurus that we should not have seats, big vyasasans in the temple. We should not have big vyas pujas. We should not have big this and that. And they were just, shut up. Don't talk like that. That's wrong. And then the guru started falling down. So then it opened people's eyes. But still, they were holding on. And at that time, as I was saying, two things were going on. There was a guru reform movement of God brothers, you know, starting to talk. And Satsarup Maharaj came out with his first book on guru called Guru Reform. So there was, you know, realization now starting, like, hey, things were wrong. We did the wrong thing. But it was not all pervading yet, but it was being discussed. And it was only because gurus were falling down that the discussion could take place, because if they never fell down, it would be, I mean, maybe we would realize the problem. Maybe we wouldn't be where we are today unless they fell down. Maybe it would take 20 more years before we have a book on Founder Acharya. But it took gurus falling down, and eventually most of them did, who were the initial, before we could just come up and say, okay, what we thought was wrong. And then the idea of Siksha Guru could develop, the idea of expanding the number of gurus. Now, today, is that clear? Do you have any question?
Yeah. Questions or comments can be done.
No, sure. No, it's fine.
I have a few.
Yeah.
Because I was a long time Pema president, maybe 10 years.
Uh-huh.
Then I found, I also noticed that Vyasa Puja Prabhupada are not like big as they should be, but sometimes, if you can say practical problems, because the day after Janmashtami, and everybody celebrates like a big, you know, very big Krishna birthday.
Yeah.
And then next day everybody starts, let's just do it, let's finish, because, you know, we have to go take a rest.
Yeah. That's true. But if that were your guru's birthday.
Yeah.
Because now in Alachua, there are 150 disciples, right? So on the last Vyasa Puja, I think there were like 187 preparations cooked, you know. And everybody takes off work, goes to, you know, it's like, because it's mostly Prabhupada. So if it's your guru,
yeah.
I mean, what you say is true, but...
I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying it's, you know, it's...
Yeah, yeah. Yes. But also then you, but at the same time, then disappearance days also. Some disappearance days are Prabhupada.
At least you get big.
Yeah. Some places they didn't. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway... Yeah. Is something else?
My question was that these gurus that time, they were not like, they didn't have like a fear if I accept so many disciples, if I will be like, they didn't have like, it's actually a big responsibility.
I never heard them talking about it. Basically, I think they understood that they were the gurus for that zone, and that's what Prabhupada wanted them to do. And so, that's what they were doing. Because they were very dedicated to Prabhupada, so there wasn't the talk of, well, I'll have, you know, if I'm the only guru in this zone, you know, multiply that by 20 years, I'm going to have, you know, thousands and thousands. I never heard that discussion go on. The basic discussion was, this is what Prabhupada wants us to do, and we just do it. This is a good question. So because at that time, there wasn't much discussion. It was just like assumptions. You know, the assumption is they're pure devotees. Prabhupada wanted each of them to initiate in this part of the world. And Prabhupada empowered us. And we're just going ahead. It was like very simple. You know, and there wasn't... You see, as I explained in another class, when Prabhupada was present, we thought we understood things which we didn't understand because he was controlling. You know, it's like you have the conductor and he's doing the orchestra, and one day he doesn't come, he's sick, and now you have to practice, and you think, well, I know the piece, but without him, you can't do it. But you actually know how to play it, but somehow you need him to make it work. So when he's around, you play fine. All of a sudden he's not there. Well, I thought I know how to play it, but when do I come in? And you know, it was like that. So, and the other thing is, there was one guru. So we didn't have to, there was, you know, if there were so many things that were the same when Prabhupada was here and after, but the guru dynamics changed from one founder acharya to many. So that was a big shift. Temples were the same. The morning program was the same. Book distribution was the same. Didi were, not, these things didn't change. So there wasn't confusion. That's where the biggest confusion was, because that was the biggest change. So then we realized we didn't really understand guru. We just understood Prabhupada, founder acharya, one guru of a movement. That we understood. In that context, was the only context we understood guru. And now there was a new context, and we realized philosophically we didn't even understand Diksha Guru, Siksha Guru, Founder Acharya. And we didn't have to understand. And anything we didn't understand during Prabhupada's time, he would clarify. So there, you know, now you might ask a question to 10 people and get 10 different answers. You know, where did the jiva fall from? Was he actually, you know, were we with Krishna? Was it from Brahman? Mahatattva? Did we fall from Goloka? In rasa? Out of rasa? You know, and then go on the internet, you know, read different things, you know. So in Prabhupada's time, these things came up. But when it got to a confusion or there was disagreement or nobody could really answer, they just asked Prabhupada, send a letter, ask him, you know, a week later you get the answer. It's finished. Prabhupada, you know, some people say that you could take initiation after the spiritual master dies. And someone on his behalf could do that. Is that true? No. Well, the controversy's finished. No back to Prabhupada movement, no blasphemous sites on the web, no controversy about who's, you know, initiated by who. 1 week later, you get the letter. No, that's not our problem. And it's, you know, that, so in Prabhupada's time, there was no confusion because it was all resolved within a week. And once Prabhupada resolved it, you would not in any way try to push any other idea, otherwise you would commit offense and look like a total fool and nobody would listen to you. So how could you say something that Prabhupada didn't say? You know, that's it. You know, Prabhupada, these devotees, you know, they're all gathering together to read about the gopis, and that's all they do. And he said, stop it, tell them to stop it. You know, the program was finished. Now, you know, 20 years ago, devotees are going to Narayana Maharaj and they're hearing all these high topics and the discussions at GBC going on for years. Is it right? Is it wrong? Narayana Maharaj this and that. And it's still going on, right? Ritvik's still going on. Is it okay to go to Narayana Maharaj? And Prabhupada, you know, one letter. No, this is... So it was... We didn't have a lot of confusion during Prabhupada's time. Because if we did, it was resolved very quickly. It didn't go on very long. And the other thing, which is really important, if you believe something, you would never do what they're doing now to promote it, because you would understand, what if Prabhupada says what I say is wrong? I don't want to put myself out on a soapbox telling the whole world this is true, because they're going to ask Prabhupada and he might say it's wrong. So you would tend to be very low-key. And you might talk personally, say, I feel like this is the way we should do it. But you wouldn't be like, you are wrong, this is the way to do it. Because there's always this idea, Prabhupada would just say, no, you're wrong, and you would embarrass yourself. And you would also, in a sense, be offending Prabhupada and showing your stupidity. So we were much more low-key about what we believed. In knowing that Prabhupada was going to resolve it and he would expose us. So you didn't have all this fanaticism like you have now. I mean, you did in a certain way, but it wasn't like major international ramification. It might just be on the local level. Maybe the women in your temple aren't taken care of because you think women are this or that. But, you know, if it got on the international level, it always got dealt with. And yeah, and it's true. And some people did get embarrassed because they made bad decisions. So now the situation is getting resolved on its own by Guru's falling, which number one tells us they weren't up here. And the second thing it tells us, when you become Guru, actually you have to think of yourself lower than your godbrothers and servants of your disciples. Now that consciousness was basically the opposite. When they became gurus, it was like, okay, we're the ones, you know, we are the ones now. Whether it was obvious that they thought it or it was just subtle, if they didn't think it, the others were thinking it and making them think it. That was also going on. They're like, no, you're this. No, I'm just this. Make more people gurus. No, we're this. That was going on also. So even you want to be humble, you were getting reinforced that you're special. Don't just give it to everybody. So they fell down and gradually, okay, we realized that they're not special. And then through the years realize that, no, you want to become guru, that means you have to be very, very humble. You don't think yourself special. But you see it as a service. Now, in those days, guru, GBC, it was all hooked up together. So that created this incredible power structure of control. And that's been something that we as a movement have had to deal with since Prabhupada left, because when Prabhupada was here, okay, he's the founder of Charya, he's the guru. So, no problem, right? Every last decision has to go through him. It's easy, very unified. Now Prabhupada leaves, another big switch. There's not one person in charge. Now it's the GBC. So, one thing I was talking about last class, which is really important to understand, is when Prabhupada organized this movement, he was very clear about how it should be managed, and he was very clear about how the GBC should manage. And it's all in written documents throughout from 1970 or 72 onwards, when he first established the GBC. You know, everything is written, and then there's the last will and testament, and then how properties are controlled, and you know, there's documents for all of that. There's no written document for gurus and expansion of gurus. Nothing. And there's only one conversation, not initiated by Prabhupada, but initiated by his disciples. Prabhupada did not initiate any conversation of how the gurus will continue after he departs. They initiated it. It wasn't the disciples who initiated trustees and documents of management. There's a document called, I think it's called something of management. I think there's two, one revived, I forget. Something of management, you know, how the movement would run. So Prabhupada and his disciples were doing this, written documents, right? So it shows what Prabhupada thought was important for the future of the movement. It was how it's going to be managed, the structure, who's going to control it. That's, you know, and he wasn't thinking, obviously, that the gurus are going to control it. Otherwise, why would he have these documents that the GBC are the managers, the temple presidents are the managers? It would have just been obvious. Oh, no, when he leaves, the gurus control everything. No, the gurus weren't even part of that management structure. That's why he didn't write anything. Because the guru is a spiritual principle. It's a relationship. It's transcendental. And then you may ask, well, why didn't he even talk about how the gurus, the cyclic line is going to go on? Why did the disciples have to ask him? And he didn't write a document. And he wouldn't even have talked to him. I mean, theoretically, he wouldn't even have spoken about it if we didn't ask him. Because he already wrote about it in his books. So he didn't need to write about it because it's a spiritual principle. It's not a managerial principle. But we looked at it as a managerial principle. You know, how's it going to go on? Who's going to be in charge of what part of the world and this and that? So then it got, guru became very hooked up with management, and because most of the gurus were GBCs. And so we never actually really saw for a while a guru who was just a guru with disciples. We always saw gurus were managers. So, you know, that also created a paradigm in our mind of this is what a guru is, which created more problems. Right? So that's very interesting that he didn't talk about it until he was asked.
And nowadays, what is your opinion about, because I heard from the sannyasis,
yes,
who are GBCs,
yeah,
they told me, you know, I'm, especially one of them told me often, I'm not a manager, but still I'm part of a disciple, I'm a sannyasi, and I'm part of GBC. And he's thinking, you know, it's not good that we sannyasis, that we are, you know, we have to travel and preach. It's not good that we are managers,
yeah,
that we are GBCs. So
yeah.
What do you think about that?
I think in general it's good, but Prabhupada was practical, so sometimes, well, okay, I was just speaking to one of my godbrothers. He used to be GBC, and then he became very sick, so he had to retire. And now he's back in his zone. And I said, and he's not GBC anymore. And he was GBC probably for 20 years. So I said, that seems weird to me. You know, isn't that weird? You know, you were completely in control, and then you got sick and recovered, and you've been out of management for 15, or I don't know, 10 years, 5 years. And he said, I said, how do you deal with that? I said, do you manage? He said, now I do what I should have done as a GBC. I'm mostly preaching. That was his reply. I'm doing what I should have done as a GBC. I'm developing preaching programs. So he did say, yeah, well, I still manage, but not from a GBC perspective. And the thing is, he's a good manager. So how could he not manage? So I think that also you have. Some people are just, they're brilliant managers. So even if you pull them out of management, they'll still have influence in terms of vision and so forth, which I think is good. But maybe the hands-on day-to-day stuff is not the best thing. I think probably, I mean, initially GBC was all grihasthas. And initially, when Prabhupada made sannyasis, he pulled them out of management because that's a traditional role. Like sometimes devotees wanted to take sannyas because they didn't want to manage. So they said, Prabhupada, can I take sannyas? And even though one person would be managing and it was too much for him, he couldn't get the sannyasis to help because they would say, I'm a sannyasi. I just preach. I travel and preach. So they wouldn't manage. So it later on took a turn because they were needed and a lot of the sannyasis were good managers and it was their nature. So, and Prabhupada depended on them. So he put them in charge. And so in Gaudiya Math you also find that. But I think in the ideal situation what Prabhupada was creating was grihasthas were temple presidents in GBC.
Those who have more nature of kshatriyas or managers or doesn't?
Not necessarily. I think it was more those who were willing to do it, like enthusiastic. I was just listening to a lecture by Hansa Dutta, and he said, Prabhupada really responded with enthusiasm. So that's where he gave empowerment or gave responsibility to whoever was not materially qualified, but enthusiastic. Because Prabhupada put more emphasis on spiritual qualification than material qualification. So he could give somebody who's not so materially qualified big responsibility. Now, I'll give you an example of myself. I was, when I was growing up, I used to have these thoughts, interesting thoughts. Just as a kid, I would look at these big corporations and I would think, oh, I'd never want to be in charge of anything like that. It was just like a natural, like reclusive mood. Like, whereas a manager would be like, wow, I'd love to manage a company with 10,000 people. You know, that passion and excitement and control. So I was very much the opposite. And so much the opposite that even as a kid, it must have been a past life. Because why would a kid think about managing? I must have like managed some company in my last life or something. Because I look at it and I think, that's horrible. That's a nightmare for me. I'd never want to do that. Right? So when I was 19, I joined the movement. No, when I was 20, I joined the movement when I was 19. And just after I turned 20, been a devotee 8 months. And then, so I just turned 20, and then I was put in charge of a temple. So now I'm the person who is not excited about managing, and I'm a young devotee. So you might say, what are the chances of your temple being successful? Right? But why would Prabhupada allow me, or why would anyone in the movement allow me? Because the principle that we operated on, and we had to operate on that time, now you may try to modify it. But at that time, you had to operate on this principle because everyone you had was new. So you had to put people who were less than materially qualified. Right? So Prabhupada used to say, okay, here's the program. You just make sure you follow. You're temple president. Make sure everybody follows the program. That was like the main thing. Right? And then he said, be sincere. So these two things were like the groundwork for your success as a manager. Right? So what did I know about management? And all we did is the whole temple went on Harinam every day. That was the program and had Sunday feast. That's all I had to manage. And we'd go to colleges, but we'd do Harinam there, or we'd go downtown and we'd do Sunday feast and occasionally do festivals. So it wasn't a big problem to manage, and you had some devotees in the temple. You just had to feed them and somehow get some money. It's a small temple. But, so I was very enthusiastic and I was very sincere to make more devotees. And I think what happened within the next year and a half, it was kind of like this happened without me even making it happen. It just happened. We opened another temple with about 8 devotees. And then in our temple, we had about 12. So that means in that year and a half, 20 people joined the movement. Which today, 20 people in a year and a half, you're like, you'll be getting awards at the Mayapur Festival, How did you do it? What strategic plan did you have? I figured this, and I studied this, and I read this management book, and I looked at our history. Nothing like that. It was just raw enthusiasm and sincerity. So Prabhupada was giving a lot of leadership responsibilities to people who were enthusiastic, who were sincere, and who could be exemplary, because that's where he put the real strength. Because it's a spiritual movement, so he saw that's the real management, you know. And sometimes he would say, your duty as GBC is to make sure everyone's chanting their rounds and following the principles, because that's where the success is going to come from. It's going to come from purity, right? So you can be a really good manager and people aren't spiritually inspired. You're not going to be as successful as a bad manager, because a bad manager will inspire people and he'll get the good managers to help him, right? So anyway, I mean, I don't know what the GBC discusses on these issues now, but at least then, that's what I saw, as you know, because so many people were temple presidents. We thought, who's a good devotee? He should be the temple president, right? Just like now, when you want to see who should be a guru, you don't think, can he manage? You think, is he pure? Does he inspire people? Is he exemplary? So it was like that. And then there's a letter. I think it was the initial letter of Prabhupada establishing the GBC, and he said, you do like I'm doing, and you be spiritual masters. Like, that was his idea. The GBC are like, you know, like representatives of Prabhupada. So I can't travel around the world, so you're in different parts of the world, and you do what I'm doing. So you're like the groove. And what does that mean? Make sure they're chanting their rounds, following the principles, like that. So it doesn't mean that someone who's a good manager is not going to be more successful. But in some cases, those who aren't good managers were more successful because more people joined. And they just got good people to help them.
Is it somehow like ideal, I mean, to be the best, to have a materially qualified like manager, and spiritually he's like very, very sincere and good? Is that the best?
I have one godbrother who's a really good manager, and he said, you generally don't find that in the same body. You generally find the really like Krishna conscious, you know, sincere sadhu is not the best manager, and the best manager is not really the best sadhu. That was, you know, I don't know how true it is, but in many cases it is true. So he told me, he was a really good manager, extremely successful. He told me, he said, I believe you need two people running a temple, the sadhu and the manager.
Like Raja Rishi principle.
Yeah. And a lot of times in Prabhupada's concept, this follows the line with Prabhupada's concept, because at least in the traditional concept of temples, the temple president was not the manager. The temple commander was the manager. The temple president was like, he was like the guru, the figurehead. He would, you know, his duties were different. So, I mean, sometimes you can't do that because you don't have both. And I think it depends on personally, I think it depends personally on the person, how they want to manage. As I took lunch with Niranjan Swami, and I said, what I think we need here in Mayapur is to give more autonomy to devotees to develop their own projects. People who are qualified, who are proven to be successful, allow them to develop a department or a project. And he said, yeah, that's exactly how I manage. He said, actually, I don't manage. I let other people manage. So it'll depend on, you know, you could say that's a very Brahminical way of managing. And that's really how Prabhupada did it, empowering. Now, when Prabhupada was in India, we didn't know India, so he would have to manage more. But in America, he was not involved in management. Only he organized the BBT and he oversaw that. But in terms of running temples, he left it to us because we're Americans. As far as I could see, his only involvement in management was in response to questions we would ask, like, should we get this temple? And then you go look at it and say, yeah, get it. You know, very minimal stuff, you know. Are my books being printed? I've translated this. Why aren't you printing? You know, it was all about books. In India, he knew how to run India. We would get cheated, so he would tell us, do this, do that, do this program, don't do that, stop this, start that. We wouldn't know. But in the West, really hands off. He just let us do it. And he let us make mistakes. That's how he managed. You know, go do it. You make a mistake, you learn. He, you know, that was his program. So then Venu and Atmananda are talking about how, Prabhupada's formation of the GBC was what his Guru Maharaj told to do in Gaudiya Math. So he was just copy. He didn't create a management system. He just followed. He said, Bhakti Siddhanta never appointed a guru. He appointed GBC. So it goes back to that point I was making, how Prabhupada put all his energy into the man. This is how the movement will run managerially. Never told who's going to be a guru. But for us, guru is like everything. You know, management is like whatever about management. It's all about the guru. And from Prabhupada's point, it's all about the GVC. That's where, it's not about this one being guru or that, whether the movement's going on. It's about you maintaining GVC and working together. That's the way the movement's going to go on, right? And so what we found out was that the who becomes guru is not really important as long as everyone remains humble. The fact that they didn't remain humble, it became important in a negative sense because it was destructive. So for that reason, it was important to deal with. But if they all did it in a pure way and were able to open it up, and we were smart, then we wouldn't have allowed the guru issue to dominate the managerial issues, but we would have focused on the management. GBC, that's what was important to Prabhupada, trustees of projects, how the movement would run managerially. And then the gurus are just their spiritual guides. But even the GBC were meant to be spiritual guides also. So you have gurus, but you also, there. It's not like you relegate managerial positions as just people who have no Krishna consciousness and they can't do anything. But the reality is, you're a temple president, you're a spiritual guide for everyone in your temple. And it's not that I can come in because they're my disciples and undermine your management. But it's not that your relationship predominates and then I have no relationship with them. It works. It's meant to work in a way which is synchronistic, or what's the word? Synergistic, right? It's just, it has its place. So once they understand you're their guide, Siksha Guru, you're like their uncle, then it's fine. But if it's only Mahatma and not you, and not even Prabhupada, then you're back to 1978. And the effects of that are still influencing us today. Because you will go to some places in ISKCON where you'll still see some sectarianism over disciples of one group versus another.
Like guru groupism.
Yeah, it still exists. There are places where they have Sunday feast, two Sunday feasts, one for the disciples of this guru and one for everybody else. Or one for the disciples of that guru who don't want to go to only a program just... So you think, how, this is 2014 and that's going on? Yeah, that's residual effect that has never been properly dealt with or integrated or somehow or other it's existing. And you know, because I went there and I thought, well, this is kind of strange. You know, and now, one thing I will say is because the movement has evolved, the ramifications of that are not as bad as they would have been, as they were 20 years ago or 30 years ago. But it's an indication that it's not entirely healthy, and there some misconceptions still will linger in the disciple's mind. Right? At the same time, it's natural. It's your guru. You. So it's still evolving. Right? And so the point of this lecture was Siksha Diksha Foundracharya, and I have to tell the whole history just so we can get to the philosophy, because the philosophy got obscured by the social and historical consequences of what happened, and it still affects us today. Right? I was just in one country, and a devotee told me, he said, you know, when the guru comes, all the disciples come to the temple, and they come to the temple, friends, can I do some service, can I do some service? He said, these are the people I never see and never ask for service. So, in one sense it's good, but in another sense it's bad, because it's a little artificial. It's only, you know, I'm inspired only by my guru. And I was just in another country, and I was giving classes, and one devotee said, you know, all the devotees of this guru, they don't go to your classes. Like everybody else came, he said. But I said, why? He said, because they think, because their guru is very learned and they think they know more and there's nothing to learn. So they don't go, they said, none of them came to your classes. So it's still that, what do you call it, groupism, guru groupie. You know, I call it more, you know, it's the reality is it's sectarianism, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the reality. So the movement has dealt with this. If you want to have a really if you're into management especially, but even if you're into history, go to gbc.com or iskongbc.com and read the resolutions. They have all the resolutions since 1975. You could read every year. And you could see, by reading the resolution, you could understand what's going on in the movement just by reading the resolutions. Because you'll come to this point where you'll get these resolutions, no chanting of the guru's name in the temple, no Vishnupad, no naming of the guru, no public, you'll see it all just get cut off. And you'll start to understand, oh, this was going on. And now they're cutting it off. And it's very abrupt. It's like within a 1 or 2 year resolution. It's like chop, 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 chop. Maybe chop too much. But it was, but it created such havoc that it just, it hit this point where it exploded and said, we have to stop this. It's, the movement is becoming disunified. You know, now you go to the temple and it's your guru and you're leading Guru Puja, you're leading Mangal Arati, so you chant your guru's name. What about everyone else? And what about Prabhupada? Oh, he's just one of many. No. All right, we'll chant two gurus' names and Prabhupada. Right. So then they actually made a resolution, I believe. I don't know, but as far as I remember, they had made a resolution. So what was happening, so that stopped, so people would, then they would chant, Gurudev, Gurudev. So Gurudev was like generic for everybody else. And Prabhupada said the name Gurudev is impersonal. Like if you're going to your guru and saying Gurudev, it's personal because you're talking to him. But to say Jai Jai Guru Dev in a general assembly, he said it's impersonal because you should chant the name of your guru, which you could do if it's only disciples together. Then you would chant, have a kirtan, you could chant the name of your guru. But where there are other disciples, you wouldn't, or at least in a public program, you wouldn't. So from what I remember, they even pulled that off the books, no chanting Jai Guru Dev, because it indicated everybody else, and they just wanted Prabhupada to be glorified in the temple. Which, you know, it seems extreme. But they still hear they chant Jai Guru Dev. And I always say, you're breaking a GBC law when you do that. They don't know. But that was the idea, just to keep Prabhupada focused. So you have a nice time. Read the GBC resolutions and you'll see the movement evolving, especially around the guru. And today where we stand is that there are still feelings by devotees that the system in which somebody becomes guru, the way it's going now, still needs to evolve further. It's not completely natural yet. And it needs to be more harmonized with traditional guru-disciple systems, and which are more natural. You find someone, you learn from them, you hear from them, you get guided by them, you get initiated from them. You know, that's the natural system. You check them out, you make sure they're qualified. Like, you know, you want to go to university. What, you want to be a doctor. What's the best university? Right? We're going to Harvard. Can I get to Harvard Medical School? Yeah, that would be the best. So you think, Harvard Medical School, okay, I'm going to try to do that. So you've checked every school out, you know. And you've narrowed it down. So it's like that, traditionally, that's how you find a guru. It's like, okay, you know, let's read the reviews on this guru. You know, let's check out the disciples. You know, how I check this guru, all those disciples, and then go to Mangal Arati, you know, and they eat ice cream for breakfast. That, not for me. He can't be, that's what you're supposed to do. And you're also supposed to see, do I fit with this guru? Can I fit within his mood and, you know, organization and so forth? Adiwal, oh, come. Get the tail end of the nectar. So that's a traditional system, right? It's totally you. If you're... Sit on the carpet is better. It's totally your responsibility. It's like you're going to buy a product, you know. You know, you get online, you read about it, or you're going to go on an airline that, you know, some people said it's not safe. You know, you read about it. So if the airline messes up, well, you decided to take it. You could, you know, didn't you know that they just had an airline crash because they don't maintain their engines, right? So, we were just talking about like disciples who, like, they're very active when their guru's present, and they kind of disappear when he's gone, and not so, you know. And how in how ISKCON, that's a problem. We went through the whole history of ISKCON and how the problems of the past still affect some people in some places. They're still manifest. This being one of them, and then also some friction between disciples, or some disciples not, they won't go to other people's classes because they think maybe their guru is, you know, he's special and he's like, he's the one and he's going to, you know, in the future it's going to be him. You know, these things still go on. At least I'm told that the disciples of this guru, they think he's the only pure devotee. And yeah, it's still going on. Definitely it's going on in ISKCON. Yes?
Can you give an example, the medicine, for medicine college person go to Harvard, he's searching for the best college. So should mentality be we search for the best guru or we search for someone who will fit? For example, maybe the Harvard college is not the best for me,
yeah,
but I would like to go to some other college who will fit me the best.
Exactly. Well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you see, the idea is, you're actually, that's a bad example, actually. Because it's true, you're not searching for the best guru. And how would you even know who the best guru is? Right? But then if you think I'm searching for the best guru and you find him, then you think I got the best guru.
Yeah.
And you don't.
And then immediately you have a problem.
No. What to rephrase it, this is good you asked the question, you're searching the best guru for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Like the best college for you, not the
best. Yeah, so Harvard was the best college for me. Because I want to go into this specialized form of medicine, and they're the best in that area. You know, so like, I'm dedicating my life to book distribution. So maybe I want to look for a guru who will inspire me in doing that. You know, like, or at least if I'm already initiated, find a six-year guru who can. So in the traditional system, and then Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, he said, live with your guru for 1 year. And the main criteria, obviously, the obvious criteria is he actually bona fide? Does he come in a bona fide disciplic succession? Does he know the Shastra? Can he teach it? And does he follow it? That's what you're supposed to be looking at. But even more important, I think, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur said this, are we compatible? And so he can be perfect, right? But is he perfect for me? Just like you may be perfect for your wife, but for another woman, you're totally incompatible. So he presented that point. So, and then there's other factors. Does the guru ever go to the zone I live in? So we're compatible and everything's great, but he's never going to preach there and I live there. Do I want, am I okay living in a part of the world where I have to travel and spend a lot of money to see my guru? So maybe you are okay. I'm not saying you wouldn't be, but these are considerations. Do you need personal attention? Maybe you don't want personal attention. Maybe you don't want a guru meddling in your life. You don't want him to know what you're doing. So, you know, you think, I'll find a guru that never comes to my country. Or he's got so many disciples, he won't even know my name. And I can just do whatever I want. I think sometimes devotees, when they'll look at guru, because a lot of gurus kind of have institutions. They have so many disciples. There's so much going on. And they may look and say, I feel comfortable in that because it's such... There's so much. He's got so many books, so many disciples, so many programs, mentorships, this and that, and I can just, so, and someone else look at that and say, I don't want to be one of 10,000. I want to be one of 100, you know? So you're all different, right? The problem is when you're one of 10,000 and 10 years later you realize you don't want to be one of 10,000. But then you can find a six-year group, so it's okay. So you can have both, right? It's all right. So in the traditional system, it's just you. You make the decision. You find, you check them out, you live. And then the guru checks you out. And you may say the guru's fine. He may say you're not fine. So that's not going to work. So that's how you do it. Now, today in ISKCON, it doesn't exactly happen that way. Because how can the guru really check you out and how can you really check him out? If you're a woman, you're going to travel with your guru for a year and check him out. You know, what time did he go to bed? What time did he get up? You know. How many rounds did he chant today? So the point is, in ISKCON, that's normally not the prime way you determine who a guru is, right? And if a guru is not chanting his rounds, it obviously comes to a point where management in ISKCON becomes aware of it and they deal with it. So if he's actually functioning as a guru in ISKCON, you kind of understand he must be qualified. If he's not, after a certain point, it becomes obvious. So that's not really the main criterion for you, generally. Although Shastra says it should be. It's more compatibility. So, and so, now where ISKCON has the problem today is ISKCON has about 100 gurus, right? Who were, I don't know how many, 100 or something. 120, 30.
Yeah. something
yeah. Who in your mind, the average devotee's minds, are approved to initiate. But the GBC says, well, they're actually not approved. We just didn't object. But when I got my letter, it said you're approved. So it's hard to say you're not approved. It's hard to say you have been not objected to. And say, so go on the dictionary and see if the synonym for not objected to is approved. Or the antonym, or the synonym, yeah. You know what I'm saying? But they want you as a disciple to make the decision and not them. Say, we don't want to say that he's authorized. But it's hard not to say it because you approved, because there's 130, if he's not, there's 130. Why isn't everybody? Why can't you just take from anybody? So some devotees feel it has to go a little further than that, where it becomes more of you finding who your guru is. More than there's a list of 130, more people can be put on it. And it's still not entirely natural. And I can say that from personal experience, that so many people now ask me for initiation that would never have thought of asking me before I was approved. So I can say from personal experience, it does have a psychological effect. And people are like, now I've been approved. I have devotees say, well, how do we address you now that you're a guru? Do we call you Maharaj? I say, I'm not your guru. You see, so that concept, you're approved, now you're a guru. Oh, he's a guru. So, well, whose guru am I? I'm the guru of my disciples. I'm the father of my daughter. You don't call me father. Now that my daughter was born in 2001, do you start calling me daughter, father? No, I'm not your father. I mean, if you want me to adopt you, I'll adopt you, then you call me father. But before that, should I call you father? Why would you? So should I call you? So people call me Maharaj because my disciples do that. I said, well, why? I mean, I don't say anything. But you see, it's still this approval idea. It's not perfect yet. Because I'm not your guru. I mean, if you want me to be your guru, fine. But if I'm not, I'm not. So it's relationship, right? It's fine. You come here, you hear a class, yeah, you're happy, And you go home. So no problem, right? She's my disciple. She goes home, she's my disciple, I'm her guru. It's different, right? So it's not an official position. But by being approved, it's a little bit institutional. And so that's the problem, It's like, well, you're a guru in ISKCON. We want to welcome Mahatma to our temple. He's a bona fide initiating guru in ISKCON. No, he's a disciple of Prabhupada. He travels and preaches. He's visiting us. That's how I should be introduced, not as an initiate. I'm not initiating. I'm her guru. I'm not anyone else's guru here. Or even if I am, but that's not my role, because then I become institutionalized as a guru. And it's just between me and the disciples. If you have 10,000 disciples, it's hard not to look like you're institutionalized, but still you're not. You really aren't. It's just a relationship. At least that's the way it's supposed to be. Now, the other really interesting thing is in the Jiva Dharma, the question was asked, how do I find a bona fide guru, or what are the qualifications? And the answer was, more important, you become a bona fide disciple. So I think that's also, I don't know if they teach this, they probably do in the guru disciple class, but I think what I've seen is when somebody's looking for a guru, they're looking for a guru. They're not looking to be a better disciple. They're looking this way. Who, is he my guru? I need a guru, I like her and this is her guru. Maybe, we live together, we'll have the same guru. This is my family. They're all initiated by this one. So you're always looking out. But he's saying, the answer to this question was, it's not a problem to find a bona fide guru. It's a problem to be a bona fide disciple. So I think there needs to be more emphasis on people looking at their qualification as disciple, even after you're initiated, but especially before. Because we have so many gurus who are qualified. So finding a qualified guru, it's not a problem anymore. There's hundreds of them. There's thousands of them, actually. And everyone in ISKCON is a guru in some sense. Right? So that's where we're evolving today in ISKCON. And we're also now we're doing a whole lot of work. Dustin, there's a lot of things going on out there you haven't heard of. So
So now, with the writing of the book Founder Acharya, and the work that there's a, I don't know what it's called, Prabhupada, there's a committee, do you know? It's like the Prabhupada Founder Acharya, some committee. What, do you know what it's called?
Something like that.
It's not the succession committee, is it? There's a committee to, there's a committee, an organization, part of the GBC, something to get Prabhupada as everyone's guru, to get everyone to realize he's your guru. As deep a relationship as you could have with any guru, your six-year guru you have with Prabhupada, as deep a relationship as every Prabhupada disciple has with Prabhupada, you can have. There's like, we have, and you think, you actually have to have a committee in a movement to teach that. That should be obvious, right? But Prabhupada got obscured so much after he left that he's never fully made it back to the center yet, that we have to have someone like Sureshwar traveling around the world just to get him in the center. That's the situation. You know, every time you see somebody trying to solve a problem, you have to think and go, oh, there's a problem. Why, you know, in, you think in a healthy movement, do you, you know, 5,000 years from now, you're going to have people flying around the world saying, hey, do you know you can have a relationship with Prabhupada? No, I didn't know that. Nobody told me. I thought I could only have a relationship with my Diksha Guru. I thought that was all there was. You mean there are other gurus? You mean Prabhupada? I could actually be connected with him? Yeah. So that's obviously a problem that you have to tell people that. So it reflects on the problems of the early days. Right? That we got so off course that you'd have to have a whole 30-hour program to say something which should have been obvious to everybody, which was obvious to us as Prabhupada disciples. So that tells you something about where we need to go. And then you have to be instructed, or many devotees need to be instructed and say, hey, do you know that there are many people qualified to guide you, to give you siksha, in which you can have this deep connection just as you have with your Diksha Guru, and they're not even approved ISKCON gurus, and they may not even be Prabhupada disciples. And you can have the same service relationship if you want. You don't have to, but it's available. And it could actually even be deeper than the relationship you have with your Diksha Guru because this person may be more prominent in your life. Now, some people spontaneously understand this because it happened to them. And fortunately, they were in a situation where they didn't feel it was wrong. But if that happened 30 years ago, it wouldn't. You couldn't allow those feelings to develop because you would have thought it's wrong. So they wouldn't develop. They were there, but they wouldn't manifest. Or if they manifest, you'd get confused and guilty. Right? Really weird, you know, that you have this really this really good relationship that's so beneficial for you, and it makes you feel guilty. And there's nothing wrong with it. So that's where we're coming from. But I'm sure today that still exists in some quarters and some people's minds. And what I have found through personal experience is that also people choose gurus and later they change their mind. Because now being a guru, I'm experiencing this on both sides of it. People have chosen me and chosen someone else, and people have chosen someone else and chosen me before they got initiated. So I'm seeing that this is going on. Now, 30 years ago, if you did that, whoa, you'd get in the office and you'd be battered and you'd feel like you did something wrong. Well, you didn't do anything wrong because it's a connection of the heart. And so we have to allow the heart connection, which is just a relationship, to manifest naturally, right? Because it does manifest naturally. That's the way the world is, right? So if it does manifest naturally, what's wrong with it? It's good. You have a six-year guru. That's great. It's just, you know, and your guru's like, hey, perfect. This helps you, right? I actually have disciples, and I don't know if they're my disciples or not, because they never told me, that are as dedicated and as close to me as my initiated disciples. And then later on I find out they're actually initiated or they have someone else as a guru, and there's no way I would have known, because there's no difference between how they deal with me and how my disciples deal with me. Like, that's healthy. But they don't make a distinction. You know, I thought, oh, I guess, I mean, I don't ask unless they ask me, do you see me as your guru? I never ask. But later on, then I'll find out, oh, she's going to take initiation, or he's going to take, and I go, oh, okay. But there was no indication from my point that at some point they wouldn't ask me. I didn't know. So that's a healthy sign.
that they have these, a lot of devotees have these very deep relationships with many gurus. So that, but it doesn't exist everywhere. Now, sometimes a disciple will want to, will aspire for a guru and then want to take from another guru. And in some zones that are still living a little bit behind the times, they're very reluctant to let them do that. They think there's something wrong with them that they would do that. You're already aspiring for this one. Why would you want to, what's wrong with you? And get him in the office and beat him in the head and make him feel bad. And you say, is this still going on today? And the answer is yes, because I am involved with this. Someone who was made to feel that it was a wrong decision to not accept the guru you were aspiring for. It was bad. It was very bad. Yes?
And how was in the time when Prabhupada came? I mean, I know how everything ended, but when Prabhupada came with idea, his idea of Shiksha Guru in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. His idea, the way it worked, here's my point. It actually worked, but nobody recognized it. You know, it was actually happening, you know. Like I have two disciples. And they're probably on the chat, right? Whoops, I just got knocked off. Prem Kishore and Rasika. I have two disciples, right? And I first met them in Houston. Personally, I met them in Houston. Well, I don't know. Rasika's here. I first met them in Houston. So they had come to Houston together to meet me, and they were following another guru at that time, and they with Anuradha and others, had traveled all over Mexico and Bangladesh and other places preaching. And so they were God brother, God sister. And so they had come to see me because they're having some difficulty with their guru. So they came. You know, they weren't married or anything. They just came as God brother, God sister. And so they were talking, you know, I said, where are you staying? And I think they were staying at where? Rasika's brother's house in Houston, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so at some point I said, are you two married or going to get married or something? And they said, no, we're just friends, which to me seemed extremely odd from the ISKCON perspective. That you'd come all the way from Mexico together, you preached around the world, you'd probably been together for 5-6 years in some way, right? And now you're traveling together, and you're coming to the workshop and sitting together, and you're coming to see me and sitting together, and you're just friends. So it didn't calculate. So later on, I found out that their previous guru, who was formerly an ISKCON guru who left, was very much against getting married. She had very bad experiences with men, and then since she came to ISKCON, she renounced. So she'd been renounced for 30 or more, or 35 years. So she, right, is that correct?
She very. Yeah, she left in 86.
And she never was married in ISKCON. I think before ISKCON she was married, right?
I thought she has two married, one before
ISKCON. Oh, yeah. But so when you met her, she wasn't married. She had renounced. Yeah. So 86, since 1986, she was renounced, and I met them a few years ago. So we're, you know, so she put a lot of stress on renunciation. So she didn't want. So she told her disciples, "Don't get married." Is that true?
Yes.
It's like I asked her when I first met her, because once I found out how she preached, then I asked Anuradha. I said, "You know, if you want to get married, just let me know. It's okay." Because I just wanted it. And she said, "No, I'm not thinking about it." You know, because that was her programming, right? So at one point, you know, so Prem Kishore Rasika, there, you know, I'm looking and saying, I'm thinking. So I think I went to Prem Kishore Rasika. I said, "If Prem Kishore wanted to marry you, would you marry him?" Or, and I said that, and they both said, "Yeah," because it was the relationship was there, but it got suppressed because of, you know. So I don't know. That's how we did it. I think that's how we said, "Yeah." So then I had to come to the other one and say, "Well, you know, I asked him the same question," and so it was kind of to them. I think it was just like, it was just obvious, you know. But my point was, the natural feelings, which would have developed a long time ago, they would have been married earlier, didn't develop because they were told not to do it. It's, you know, there was no soil for it to grow. The seeds were sprouting, but it couldn't grow. The pot was too small. So I think in Prabhupada's time, we did have these relationships, like with sannyasis, highly respected, and people, you know, if you look at the history of Radha Damodar Party, you have these young men, and Vishnujan and Tamal Krishna Maharaj, who are the senior men in the movement. They're just, even some of those boys today would say, you know, he's still my guru, he's my six-year guru. He took care of me from day one. So you'll see those relationships. But we didn't call it six-year, we didn't know what it was. It was just there, you know, it was there. But it was in a small pot. It didn't fully manifest because we didn't know.
It was different, because if you want to have some Shiksha Guru who was Prabhupada, God rather, you have to go out of ISKCON, then it was probably...
Yeah. And I was going to talk today about going out of ISKCON, but we kind of ran out of time. About what I mentioned earlier was that the way the Shiksha Guru first manifested in our awareness of what Shiksha Guru is it manifested outside of ISKCON. When people left to take shelter of one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, and they developed so much faith and trust and surrender, then that concept of Shiksha Guru came, is that I'm fully surrendered to this person. Whatever he wants me to do, I will do. Which for us was like, well, but you know, what about Prabhupada? You know, it was kind of like, yes, Prabhupada's there, but he's alive and he's guiding me, and you know, it was confusing for us. Especially because he's outside of ISKCON. So that created some problems. But that's how we started to become aware of, you know, a disciple can have this fully surrendered relationship with the Shiksha Guru, just as they have with their Diksha Guru. So we'll have to talk. I wanted to talk a little bit about how that started happening, why people were going outside of ISKCON. Because it still, you know, it still happens, maybe less now. Because the people they're going out to take shelter of have left, so the intensity... Or, you know, now there's not that person to meet. But within the confusion that was going on in ISKCON, it attracted many people outside to find more stability or to find what they felt more seniority and knowledge about all these things. Maturity. Yeah. So, we have some comments here. Venu and Atmananda say she was not supposed to marry. She just wanted to safeguard our spiritual lives. She actually advised me to get married on condition that it would be someone of the same. Oh, she was not opposed to marriage. It seems that if she wasn't opposed to it, but it seems it came down to make devotees feel they shouldn't do it. Is that true?
What?
He's saying that she wasn't opposed to devotees getting married. Mother Natasha. But I'd say from my experience it seemed that she was. At least from what the other disciples told me that she was. At least that's the way it came down to them.
So they had some lady guru.
Yeah. She had left ISKCON. So Madhava Priya is saying there's so many gurus, so many wonderful classes, they're all wonderful. And the more the merrier. Right? It's like you're eating, you know. You can eat 5 preps, you can eat 10 preps. 15's even better. Right? They're all good. Right? So things are better, but they're not perfect yet. But I think the one thing that I think about a lot is that even if you are in ISKCON and end up with the wrong guru, he's still the right guru because he's Krishna conscious, and you can always take shelter of so many other gurus. So you never really end up with the wrong one because he's not teaching anything wrong and he's not living wrong, and you have other options. Right? And your guru won't be physically present forever, so you may want to take shelter guidance from others also. Yes? Any questions, comments, arguments, corrections, or additions?
I would like just to comment in that time. This, as Prabhupada came in the beginning, at least as I see, he didn't object that disciples, also can ask for advice someone else, but then he saw with the time that his god brothers doesn't help him and they really like, you know, against, then he just probably stopped.
Well, it's this idea. Yeah, it's part of the talk I would give about Shiksha Guru, but what... Look at how Krishna arranged for Prabhupada to preach. He tried to do it with his family. They wouldn't do it. So he had, could you imagine Prabhupada came to America with his wife. And then, she didn't like it. She said, well, I want to go back. You have to come back and, we have problems. Well, I can't come with you because of the kids. And then Prabhupada's every month going back to India to see his kids, It's like, and then, but Prabhupada tried, that's what he wanted to do it with his family. He wanted her. He wasn't thinking of taking sannyas. He wanted them to participate. And he also wanted his godbrothers to participate. He always wanted them to be unified in spreading Krishna consciousness. And even when he was forced to establish ISKCON, a separate movement from the Gaudiya Math, he was still inviting them to come. And he invited Sridhar Maharaj, who lived in Nabi, his temples in Nabi, he invited him to live in Mayapur.
To take care of the...
To preach to the devotees. Yeah, so Prabhupada said he's, Bhakti Siddhanta said he's, I forget how he explained it, he said he's, incredible preacher. I think Bhakti Siddhanta said he's one of the finest preachers. He said, Maharaj, come here, help my disciples. Because Prabhupada's one person with 5,000, 10,000, how can he train everybody? So he's, come, you can train my disciples, So he invited him over. But Sridhar Maharaj eventually didn't come. He invited disciples of his godbrothers to preach with him in America. He was always trying to get them. Not one person came to help. And this is my personal opinion, is that it would be confusing for us. It wouldn't have worked out, so Krishna just didn't let it happen, right? So, and then there's this famous statement, what if my godbrother says one word different from what I say? So that was a concern, they might... I think what Prabhupada meant is they might say something to undermine him. Philosophically, or practically they might insist on something, No, women can't live in temples. Now we're all upset. All the women are upset because so-and-so Maharaj, Prabhupada's godbrother, who's preaching with Prabhupada, said women can't live in temples. Bhakti Siddhanta didn't do it. It's not right. And then we'd get confused. And that would seem to undermine Prabhupada's authority. So I'm happy that he didn't get help because I think it would have been really difficult for us. So one definition of Siksha Guru is one who supports the instructions of your Diksha Guru, right? And now what I find here's another thing which is very interesting. Now you're all a little bit younger than me, and especially young men tend to be more attached to doing things in a specific way than they are when they get older. When you get older, you kind of just, it's like you've done it and you get tired. And you just get more, like your grandparents, they're just like, they're always just giving. So if you'll notice devotees now, my generation, in terms of wanting to control and manipulate, they just do it out of duty. They're very happy to give power and control to other people. They don't care. But 28-year-old gurus aren't like that. They're the exact opposite, right? Where they want to dominate. This is my zone and dominate, and you do this and you do that, and you don't like me, get out. And it was like that. It was just a very controlling situation. So we've evolved out of that, but that's the state we came from, right? So now you say, I want, this person's my Siksha guru, and it's like, great. Fantastic. The guru's happy that you have 6 years. In those days, why are you going to him? Is there anything wrong with me? This control was so intense that they couldn't allow disciples to have those kinds of relationships because they felt that they were being unchaste and they were losing control. Just as like if your wife has a very close relationship with another man, you'll feel weird. It's like, why are you, right? If it's her brother, it's like, oh, it's your brother, of course, Right, so in those days, it was like your wife with another man. He's my old friend. We grew up together. This and that. No, that doesn't feel. Just me. No, there's nothing there. He helps me with my artwork and this. So it was like that. Just like no, I'm not allowing this. You're my disciple. You can't. So now it's the opposite. Now it's like yes. I have godbrothers where I'm preaching in certain countries, and they're saying, well, I'm glad you're here because. You can. Everyone who comes can be your disciple because I have enough. I don't need any more. I'm plenty busy. You know, whereas maybe in those days it was like, you know, get more and more. So now they're like, you know, come, take them. They're all yours. You want them? I have enough, you know. Or, you know, people are asking for initiation. Yeah, well, just wait. You know, Guru Maharaj, I've been waiting 5 years. Wait a little longer. It's been 7 years. Okay, I will think about it. Yeah. So it's a different mood now, at least for many.
Yeah, but still, you can see in ISKCON some like traditional gurus, they don't find it very useful to have someone else.
Yeah, that's true. And that creates somewhat of a disunity. And I think the point you're making is it's more an East-West paradigm, right? The Western paradigm is more open. The Eastern, the traditional paradigm is you're my disciple and that's it. But it creates that problem also that those temples can be a little sectarian. And then you get the, you know, he's the pure devotee. He's the one. And I heard that some disciples of one guru left ISKCON because of that. Or they're having difficulty functioning with ISKCON because they think their guru is the one. Maybe he is, even if he is the one, that's not how we're supposed to function. Let that one purify ISKCON and inspire everybody, not separate. No problem that he's the one or the two or the three. That's fine. Because you might ask, or say, well, what if someone like Prabhupada appears? Now what do we do? Does he take over ISKCON? No. GBC runs it, and we all work together. One big happy family. Hugs and kisses. No problem. Yes? That's what it's supposed to be like. So it's evolving that way, but you know, because we're dealing with devotees of different cultures and the way they see guru and the way they take it, it's different. Because you're dealing with, I go to some countries and I can see the guru culture is so different than the Western culture that I just go to their house and take prasadam and talk to them, and they say, "You're my guru," and that seed was already planted by somebody else. Before they even met me. It was planted by one of their friends. You should take, he's really Krishna conscious, this and that. You should take him. He's, you know, he's our hero. And this and I go there and I talk to him and say, "You're my guru." And I was like, wow, I'm your guru in 5 minutes? That's amazing. So that's still going on, you know, because it's part of that culture. You know. But once they accept a guru, they'll never give up that guru. That's also part of the culture, and they'll follow. So, you know, even though that sounds weird, they may end up being better disciples than the Westerners who took 3 years to figure out who the guru is, who are so mental that they couldn't, you know, get it together. So you have both things going on. So, you know, I think those differences will always be there, but as far as possible, we want to educate. And we want to help devotees. Okay. Okay, so I think we should end here. Unless there's anything else you're dying to ask.
A lot.
What?
I think I have a lot to ask.
Ask one. Okay, we'll let you ask one question.
It's not like a question.
Okay, say something.
I just was thinking about my situation and this item we should talk now. It's like I'm always thinking about this a lot because actually
thinking about what situation?
About Shiksha Guru, because for me it's, I even came to my Guru Maharaj with this question, but it was a very short conversation and I'm still like not sure what should I do. Because before I had one Mataji, I'm telling you.
Don't tell
because
it?
Because she actually, my translator, Guru Maharaj, couldn't understand my English because it's very weird. And she was translating for him.
You speak Russian?
No, I translate English to English.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes she talks in ways that's like this, and what's your question? So sometimes I have to translate also.
Okay.
Yes. But anyway, when I asked him, who should I...
This one?
Yeah.
My phone?
Do the radio. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Hello.
Okay.
I will chat a bit quick.
She'll translate. You know what she's going to say? Because she said this before.
Is there a difference between taking instruction from somebody in service and Shiksha Guru?
Yeah, definitely.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like it's saying,
okay.
Is there a difference between being friends and being lovers? Because in our Western culture, men and women are friends. today, right? You know, these are your, well, is anything going on? No, we're just, you know, we play in the same band, and, you know, we hang out together after we play, and there's nothing going on, and I have my boyfriend over there. That's, you know, so it the thing is, at least I can express it from my realization, is that relationships are not mental. You don't ask, do I have a relationship with this person? Is it, you have it or you don't? So we gave a class last night, and I was saying how in ISKCON there's so many things which are so easy to figure out, but then we bring in the philosophy and we get confused. For example, a devotee was asked in a class by a brahmachari, why do men get married? Because if you go to the shastra, it says, you know, basically it's a dark well and this and that, and you know, and women are maya and, you know, whatever else it says. You know, you work hard like an ass and, you know, this and that. So he's asking the question, why do men get married? And Godbrother of mine said, he said, because it's natural. So my point was, you can get totally mental and confused about why do people get married, and it says this and that, and you could write papers and debates and committees, and it says, no, because it's natural. So we don't want to get, the philosophy sometimes confuses us, and in that confusion, what is obvious and natural, we don't connect with it or see, right? So it's like there's a cartoon, and in the cartoon, I forget the context of the cartoon, but it always ends, maybe you can help me, it's an American cartoon, it always ends, are we having fun yet? That's the, like, you have to ask yourself, are we having fun yet? You know that cartoon? It used to be a bumper sticker or something. Are we having fun yet? You know, it's like you're doing something and you ask, are we having fun yet? Is this fun? Well, you know, it's like Prabhupada says, you know, you don't ask the waitress, am I full? How would she know? But so sometimes we get in our mind and say, is it a relationship? Is it not? Is it right? Is it wrong? It's like asking the waitress if you're full. You know if it's a relationship or not. It is or it isn't. You know, it's just I get instruction and I like the instruction. And he helps me a lot or she helps me a lot. And that's it. That's all it is. You know, it is what it is. Now I get this instruction and I feel this inspiration and desire to serve and surrender, and I think about the person and I want to help them in their service. That's something different. And that's what it is also. And either one is okay.
Actually, this problem I had, I was accepting all people who was engaged me in service as my Shiksha Guru. And it was a big problem because it was very difficult in some ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Couldn't be my Shiksha Guru.
Or you could define, then it depends how you define Shiksha Guru. Okay, you're my Shiksha Guru for the next hour. I'm listening to class, I'm your Shiksha Guru, and in 5 minutes I'm not, right? If you want me as your Shiksha Guru after 5 minutes, that's fine also. But for now, you know I'm your Shiksha Guru. You ask me a question, and so you could accept it that way. Or you could accept it another way and say, well, Muhammad said this, but he's not my Shiksha Guru. You know, it makes sense. Maybe I'll ask my Shiksha Guru what he thinks, you know, because, and then I'll accept what my Shiksha Guru says, because that's where I have faith. That's fine also. So it depends how you want to accept it. So you don't want to give your entire life. And maybe it has to do with your own psychology of being, maybe you're a very dependent person, you know?
I think so.
Yeah, so your psychology is getting in the way because you may depend more on other people's instructions than you're using your own guidance and intelligence. So then that would be a problem. So you have to be careful.
And is there some difference, actually, between Shiksha Guru and mentor?
Yeah, definitely. And the difference is whatever difference you want to put on it. Because you have to decide. I mean, that mentor could become a Shiksha Guru.
Yeah.
But generally, generally, when someone says Shiksha Guru, you have to ask them, what do you mean by that? Because it could mean many things. You know, like Venu Rati here, she's listening, and I'm her Shiksha Guru. But she told me, she said, you know, she said something like, you know, when you understood me so well and I developed, I said, she went through this process. She said she developed more attachment for me than her guru. And she was feeling, and I said, no, it's okay. And I said, write your guru. And he was very happy. So it was just a natural process. It was something her guru is a sannyasi, I'm a grihastha, she's a woman. It was just, it was easier for her. And so this relationship developed. And he was happy. There was no problem. So it develops, it develops. It doesn't develop, it's okay. So, you know, she could have said, oh, I'm very inspired by you, I see you as a Siksha Guru, but it would have been different. I don't see you as like my Diksha Guru. No? So it depends on how you want it, you know, and how you define Siksha Guru. I know some godbrothers say, you know, my godbrother is my Siksha Guru, but they're not bathing his feet every day and offering him flowers. But they feel in their heart, if there's any confusion in my life, that's the person whose ultimate decision I will follow. They feel that. So that's different than, you know, in the office you get instruction or you go to a class, right? You know, I went to a class, I heard one thing. I went to another class, I heard another thing. This is the person I'm going to go to and say, can you resolve the difference because you're the one, whatever you say, I accept, I have faith. That I would say, okay, is a Siksha Guru. Or for some people, that's Prabhupada. It doesn't have to be anybody physical. No, he's the one. Especially older devotees, you'll see that. They're really close with Prabhupada. So does that answer your question? You're more confused, less confused?
No, I just have more questions, but it's okay.
But your psychological dependence, I think, is could be a problem.
But maybe it's another thing. Maybe it's not this psychological dependence. Just think I'm feeling I need Siksha Guru in my life. And because I don't have, I try to accept different people.
No, let it.
Because also we have a guru and many disciples, maybe she's not feeling so close all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So that's fine. But don't force it. It's like, you know, I need to get married. There's a guy. Let me walk next to him. See if that, you know, it's like, how do I feel the vibes from him? You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So it's not. So it, let it happen naturally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in other words, if you have a desire for a relationship with another, with someone as a Siksha Guru, uh-huh. and you're open to it, Krishna will send it. If you understand what it is and the kind of relationship you want, so you want something deeper than just an instruction of authority. So just be open to it. Krishna will send it. That's all. It's simple, actually. Don't complicate it. If it doesn't happen, don't go to bed crying. You know, because you don't. Why make it happen if it's not happening? You can't legislate your own faith. But when you have faith in somebody, it's going to manifest because faith is real, and you're going to feel it. And it's like, I can really, you know, I really have so much trust in this person, and I have such a strong desire to take guidance and serve. It's natural. If it doesn't develop, why force it? And if it does develop, why hide? Why run away from it?
Yeah,
that's all.
I can understand it very well. Yeah.
Simple. Yes. You wanted to say something.
I think, from the point of Shastra, this guru, Siksha Guru is like a guru tattva, while mentor can be like a counselor, giving advices, but again, from another point of view, Siksha Guru is also giving Siksha advices or counseling. So in one point of view, they're the same, and then another point of view, they're different. So I don't know.
Yeah, or it may evolve. But I think also, yeah, it could depend on the culture within that part of the world of how they, you know, see Siksha and mentorship and Diksha and but I see it as something natural because there's so many people who are disciples, especially of gurus who have a lot of disciples that I'm very close with, more so than the ones who have less disciples because they're getting less attention. They tend to gravitate more because I think they need it more. And if that happens, you know, so let's say you're a mentor for someone who's, you know, a disciple, a guru's got 7,000 disciples, and you're really Krishna conscious and you're really helping them, it's probably natural that relationship's going to be very close. Or maybe you're not that Krishna conscious. You don't even compare to their guru. So for you, it's just like practical guidance you give them really helps them. But that deep spiritual inspiration and faith, it's not there for you. So then you're just a mentor. So I think there are different degrees. And I think the word is used kind of loosely. He's my Siksha Guru. I think some people say that in terms of he's the one I'm getting most of my instruction from. But it doesn't necessarily mean there's this relationship of service and faith. So, but that's okay, because you decide how you want to use it. But I think the real sense of the term is that where there's a relationship. You know, because I have a lot of people say, can I be your sixth guru? Because I'm present at the time. Like, I'm in Mayapur. Then I'll leave, you know. You be my sixth guru. And so then I go, and then I see them a year later. But there's nothing really there. It was just like, while I was there, they were getting guidance from me, and they were having problems, and it helped a lot. And they had a lot of faith. And then the problem's over, and I'm gone, and I never hear from them again. And I see them, oh, Haribo, how you doing? And they don't say, I want to see you or anything, or, you know. So it could be time circumstance. But during that time, they saw it as the sixth relationship because they accepted everything I said and it helped them. And that's all they needed. And they didn't need anything else. So, okay. My point is let it go naturally. If it goes naturally, then you don't get boggled down by, is it a siksha? Is it a mentor? Is it okay if it's a mentor that I give them a flower? You know, if it's a mentor, should I give them a flower? Should I actually ask them if I should do, what if they get instructions but I don't do service? Is that, you know, we get, it's just let the heart go. Naturally, if they're instructing you, you'll want to give a flower, right? It's not like, what shloka is there? Is this bona fide, giving a flower? Will my guru get upset? You know what I mean? It's not, don't get mental, it's a relationship. And I told the other class, I said, for years people would ask me for diction. I said, no, I'm not going to do it. Instead, I was afraid of it because I was afraid the relationship would be artificial. Because I saw how diksha disciples dealt with our guru, and I looked at that and I said, I don't want to be in that situation where somebody's doing this because they have to. I want them to do it because they want to. I said, so if I stay six, if I don't give diksha, and if they do it, I know they're doing it because they want to, not because they have to. I felt more comfortable with that. So, but even if you have a diksha disciple, you feel comfortable because they want to, not because they have to. So it's real. It doesn't mean that once you take diksha, you don't, because you don't have to, but you know what I'm saying. Okay? This conversation could go on forever, but it will continue Saturday at 7 o'clock. Right here or somewhere near here. Okay? Is that all right?
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. So goodbye to all of you, and we will see you.